Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for having me. I would much rather be in Fort Worth, but unfortunately, my oncologist had other plans for me, so I am here, coming off of chemo this morning. So if I'm a little jittery or whatever, just blame the drugs, because clearly I know what I'm talking about normally. I understand there are also some things going on right before this and right after this, so I think that we'll have plenty of time to get you to the next set of events afterwards. And with that, I'm going to switch over to a slide view. If at any time you need to interrupt me, I think that microphone works. Present some ideas, and then hopefully we have time for some conversation and questions afterwards. So with that, let me see if I can get this part to work. And hopefully you're seeing a slide here. Yes, good. This presentation, I'm recording a screencast of it, so if you want to relive the fun later, feel free at my website, which is right there. Also, always up for 140-character conversations via Twitter. And if you've never had a really intense conversation in Twitter, it's a special thing, let me tell you. Mine usually goes about an hour until I realize that we were actually having a violent disagreement. And then you're like, wait, what? No. Anyway, so what I want to talk about today is moving past the deficit model and demonstrating our work for our libraries. This is, I'm going to talk about this in three parts. I want to talk, really, this is about community engagement. How do libraries and librarians reach out to the community? How do they advertise their services? So part of it's marketing. But how do we really model and think about that community and the people within it? And I think that oftentimes our commitment to service and our historic commitment to the idea of information and collection sometimes really get in the way. I know it sounds odd to say that service somehow gets in the way, but service really puts you in a position of wanting to help people. And people who need help are people who have problems. And what we need to start thinking about is being much more proactive, which is people who have problems also have aspirations. They also have objectives and dreams, and that's really what librarians and libraries should be looking for. So what I want to talk about today is, first of all, this deficit model, the idea of how do we approach how we think about our community in terms of information needs and how we market them. Then I want to talk about what I consider one of the most fundamental problems we have these days in library and information science, and that's the concept of the user. And so kill the user is actually what I think we need to do. And then finally, I want to talk about how when you sort of re-engage the community, when you look at the community in a very different way, you can begin to look at the community as a set of resources and how we can reposition the library as a platform to truly serve the values, talents, materials, ideas of the community, not simply create a collection that people can borrow from. So with that, I'm going to jump into this deficit model. I want to talk at the beginning here about two types of deficit thinking, that when we look at our communities, we see deficits. And the one deficit is what we expect of the community, and the other is how we market to the community. And the story I often tell about this actually is a Syracuse University story where I am. We used to send lots of great sociology and social work interns and students into the community downtown. Downtown Syracuse may sound like it's a small place, but actually it's one of the places that ranks very high in poverty, ranks very high in youth violence, ranks very high in racial issues. And so we have a South Side that is in desperate need of services. And so we used to send all these students in until finally the community said, please don't send them anymore. We're tired of being told how we're broken. And it created this really sort of town and gown divide where the town said, you keep sending us students to fix us, and we don't look at us as broken. And it created this sort of silence between the town and the university for years and years until we got a new chancellor in. And the chancellor began this idea of something called scholarship in action. And what she began to say was, Nancy Cantor is our chancellor. She began to say, look, true scholarship, true service, isn't just writing papers and talking to other scholars. It's finding solutions to problems, but it's also finding opportunities. And imagine that this downtown Syracuse is an area that can take advantage of the opportunities the university creates. And now what happened is we went re-engaged in the South Side. It took a long, long time to get them to trust the university. But the way we did that is we said, look, we're not here to fix you. We're here to figure out what you want to do. Do you want to start businesses? Great. We're going to hook you up with students in the business school. Do you want to preserve the community heritage you have. Great, we're going to fix you up with some folks in the information school that can work on creating oral histories and create documentation and such. And what happened was it became a partnership where the South Side was starting to say, this is what we need, this is what we want, this is where we want to go. And it built a much stronger relationship between the university and the town. And it was because we got over the idea of thinking, we're here to fix you. I mean, it's like, you know, how, if you want someone's opinion of how you dress and every time they tell you how fat it makes you look, how often are you going to ask their opinion after a while? And I think when you think of libraries, we spend a lot of time worrying about, do people read enough? Do people have enough literacy? Do people take advantage of online opportunities? And we define them as problems. But I want to start first with what we expect of them. And this is an example out of an academic example. And I apologize for lots of text and reading, but give me a second. As the availability of online resources has proliferated over the past decade, reference and instruction librarians have found themselves consulting with and teaching undergraduate students who are often satisfied with the good enough results they find when exclusively searching Google for research assignments. The reason that these students initially search Google include familiarity with it, the ease of access and navigation, convenience, and the use of natural language. This phrase, good enough, is a devilish evil phrase, because what this person really wants to say is undergraduates are lazy. And when you talk to undergraduates, and by the way, high school students are lazy, and middle school students are lazy. These people just take good enough. Whatever just comes to them, they'll just take them and walk away. But this idea of good enough actually comes from a much deeper understanding and concept, and it often gets misconstrued. Good enough is seen as this sort of floor, this laziness where the bar keeps getting lower and lower. And we need to think of it actually as a ceiling for a moment. I'll explain that in a second. The other is, look at the reasons they're giving for using Google. Familiarity with it, ease of access and navigation, convenience, use of natural language. These sound like very positive reasons to use anything. I think if we said people come to the library because they're familiar with it, they find it easy to use and convenient, I think we would consider ourselves a success. But let's take this idea of good enough for a moment. And there's a guy who got a Nobel Prize for thinking about good enough, and his name was Herb Simon. And Herb Simon was at Carnegie Mellon, and what he was an economist, and he also was very interested in artificial intelligence and computing at the time. And what he tried to do, and what he came up with this idea, is he looked at system optimization, which, let me tell you, sounds riveting and exciting, and it can be. But he came with a really interesting idea. He said, look, when anyone's trying to solve a problem, information problem, an economic problem, a staffing problem, etc., what they want to do is they want to get the maximum effect for the least amount of cost. Kind of makes sense, right? You want to get a big bang for your buck. And what we do is we want to optimize this. So we want to get this line that says, here's a really high effect for a low cost, and avoid this line, which is, we didn't spend a lot, but the truth is it didn't do much. And the worst, of course, is we spent a lot, and we didn't get much effect. We've all lived in that world. But what Herb Simon did is economists have been optimizing the system for a long time. But they assumed that you knew all the variables at play, sort of this notion of what's called perfect knowledge. That is, you knew what you could affect, and you knew how you could affect it, and you knew that what that effect would do to people. And what Herb Simon said is, that doesn't work. That's not the real world. The real world is you're always working in imperfect information. You're always working with half the story. You're always making stuff up and making guesses. And in that world, what people do is they will satisfice. In other words, they will take a good enough answer. And when they do this activity, when they go to Google, when they do whatever, they don't do it because they're lazy. They do it because they have no idea how much more effect they're going to get for whatever cost. So take an undergraduate, for example, in college. He goes to Google. He searches on a topic. He finds lots of Wikipedia stuff. He cites them in his paper, and he gets an A. Great. It was easy. Didn't spend much time. I got citation. Low cost in terms of time expended. High effect. On the other hand, he hands in the paper and he gets an F. Well, guess what? On the revisions of those papers, or on the next paper, he's going to go to Wikipedia, but then he's going to follow the citations and get resources and find the good stuff. Allison Head of the Information Literacy Project found this. It was, Wikipedia is the resource that shall not be named by undergraduates, which is almost all undergraduates start at Wikipedia, but very few cite them. Why? Because they've learned over their college career that that is a very low-cost activity that leads to very little effect. So they start there, and then they add more effort and get a higher effect. Joyce Valenda once talked very proudly of the fact that her students would no longer use Google. They would only use cited resources and online databases. And I said, really? She goes, yes. I said, to find Britney Spears' birthday, they go to online databases and find a peer-reviewed source? And she goes, well, no. But in school, they don't. And I said, of course, because you've shown them that while it may be low cost to use these online resources, it has low effect. We've trained them. We've given them clarity of variables so they can make a better determination. My point of this is when we look out at our communities and when we assume their information-seeking skill, when we assume where they look for information, when we assume why do they go to Google and not us, or why do they go to this and not us, and the short answer is because they don't know any better. Librarian after librarian after librarian tells me, you know, once I get the undergraduates or the professors into the library and they see what's available and they see how easy it is to use, they become lifelong users. We just need to get them in. That's not laziness that kept them from walking into the library. It's because they've been effective without it. And they assume that it has a much higher cost to use it than possible. So part of what we need to do is when we look at our students, when we look at our residents, when we look at our parents, when we look at our members, is to say these aren't lazy people who don't know better. These are people who have found that they can be very effective at a lower cost, and we need to either become a low cost, and I mean that not in terms of dollars and cents, partially, but in terms of amount of effort, to get very high effect. In essence, if you walk into the library, 12th grader, you're going to get an A on your paper, and it's going to actually be easier than if you sat at home and just looked at Wikipedia. So that's one way we need to think about this deficit model, which is that people aren't lazy. People satisfice. People will take good enough, not because it's the floor and the easiest thing to do, but because they found it to be the most effective thing to do. And if we want them to change that information-seeking behavior, we need to either show them that it doesn't cost more to get more high-quality information, or that the effects are so much greater that it's worth the additional cost. But the real issue of the deficit model is the notion of how we do advocacy and remediation. So this isn't how we view our community so much as how we reach out to our community. And so I want to take three areas where we do outreach on a pretty regular basis. Literacy and reading, technology skills, and internet access. So these are three things that we as a public library, but also school libraries, academic libraries, we go out there and we say, this is something that libraries can help at. But what I want to do is I want to look at it as a remediation view. What is the remediation view or approach of reading, tech skills, internet access? What kind of activities that turns into, sort of remediating activities. And then let's look at how we can promote the library by looking at some activities in an advocacy model or aspirational model. So reading. Low literacy rates. That should be literacy, not illiteracy, but I apologize. The idea that what we see is low school performance. We see lots of people who can't read or can't read at grade level. And we sit there and say, the community can't read. Libraries can help because our community has this reading deficit. So what do? We're going to host tutoring services. We're going to have reading hours. We're going to have book clubs. In essence, what we're going to do is set up all of this idea that outside of the formal school system, we're going to teach you to overcome your gap. What if instead what we looked at reading was exploration? The idea that you can see many worlds. And by the way, I don't mean to imply that all libraries are doing one or the other. We could see examples of this idea of come to the library and discover lots of different worlds, explore different places, visit the whole universe through reading. That's a very different thing than you can't read, let's come help you to. If you read, you can do this exploration, finding different worlds. Questioning authority. This is one that I think libraries have stepped away from for a long time because we see it as somehow a biasing activity. But what's very interesting is, why do we promote reading? And you say, well, we promote reading because it's good and social good and people participate. But actually, if you look at our history, particularly in the Edwardian era and Dewey era and the Victorian era in England, public libraries were set up not to have people question authority, to teach them to be better advocates or participants in society, but in essence to pacify the masses, to reach out to people to say, this is the right way to read, this is the right thing to read, this is the right. We actually have a history of being pretty paternalistic when it comes to reading. Now, I think we can really talk about the idea of come to the library to question the authority, to become a participant in your own government, to become a participant in the world society. Come in here and figure out what's wrong with the world and how you can be a part of solving it. Right? And then the idea of reading and writing. One of the things we're going to talk about in a minute under Kill the User is that we often forget that people produce and create and don't simply consume and walk away. When we promote reading, do we simply say it's enough to read and walk away, or do we say, did that inspire you to either read something else or write something else? What about the idea of creating writing centers within a library, creating online repositories of community materials, creating literacy magazines that can be generated on the fly from community-generated materials? What about becoming a publisher of the community, where people can literally take their wonderful next tome and they can work with the library to distribute it and publish it? One of the things we're talking about here at Syracuse is self-publishing by academics is becoming pretty important. But when you go to services like Lulu.com or CreateSpace, which is Amazon's version, or even Nook, which is Barnes & Noble's version, they have production issues. How do we format it? How do we get it into the system? How do we price it? How do we market? How do we advertise it? And what's happening is that academics are realizing that some of the publishing houses, traditional academic publishers, they don't market very well. They depend on us to do it. And if we're going to market our own materials, why bother going through a publishing house and giving up 86-88% of the revenue? And looking at our academic libraries as places where they'll help us with production, editing, copy editing, things of this nature, and they'll become more or less a new version of an academic press, not one that has inventory and paper, but that produces materials and then uses services like Lulu and CreateSpace and Barnes & Noble Space to make those available. Right? So we have writing clubs. We have banned book weeks where we talk about the idea of how, you know, why are these banned? We're challenging people to new ideas. Now in tech skills, we see that low income access, that people with low income or in need communities have very little access to technology, or their technology access is restricted to things like cell phones, where they may have access to the internet, but it's a very different access than you would get on a PC or a laptop. Or we see the elderly and senior communities having trouble accessing the technologies, right? And so we create activities like workshops, come in and learn email. We have Kindle book loading where you can bring your Kindle and we'll get the book on there for you. But this is one of the things that we're finding as technology is evolving and the personal computer is evolving to the tablet is evolving to the ecosystem. You see this in Apple's world. You see Microsoft wanting to do this. You even see Google wanting to do this. They're creating walled gardens, where it gets very easy to consume and use information if you sort of buy into their world, but it's very difficult to produce information. Think about for a moment, the tablets are taking over and that's fantastic, and if you have an iPad, it's great because you can rent movies from Apple, you can get apps from Apple, you can, listen to music, you can watch movies, it's great. But what if you want to produce the next great movie? What if you want to produce the next film? What if you want to make an app? You can't do it on the tablet. You have to have a PC. So these activities of remediation where we're giving people access to technology, what we're really doing is helping them buy into a consumer-driven society. We're actually making it harder for them to produce and create new things. So in an advocacy standpoint, when we look at the idea of aspirations versus remediation, what about the notion of publishing? Looking at economic development. One of the things that's happening at the Chattanooga Public Library, for example, is they have what's called the fourth floor. And on the fourth floor, not only do they have 3D printers and do they have other things, but they have hackathons. They have tech petting zoos, not where you just come in and try it out, but you get to build technologies. They have people building, I'm guilty of this, by the way, in LIS education. We had an activity on library innovation, and Meg Bacchus, who's now at Chattanooga, Tennessee, taught it and exceeded expectations. I knew that she was teaching a different class was when I went down to visit the class one day and saw 12 librarians with protective eyewear and soldering irons working on what they called TV outs. These were sort of chips that you could walk into a sports bar, press a button, and turn all the TVs off. So she was teaching the idea of social disobedience by actually promoting social disobedience. It's a very different way of teaching it. But the students loved it because they were involved and they were hands-on and they were making things happen. This idea that tech skills is more than teaching people how to be good consumers of these walled gardens, we can teach people how to create their own environment, their own apps, their own things. And that becomes a way of promoting ourselves to the community as a place not only simply to make up for a gap, but to make a place where we can create a whole new community that's building new economies, that's participating in these economies, that is getting the message and word out. Same with internet access. We talk about things like rural connectivity. People out in the sticks don't have internet access, and frankly, satellite-based access stinks, right? And so we do things like we provide public access machines. Well, that's true. There's a digital divide that's very real. But once again, in how we think about matching this digital divide, are we saying we're going to let people get internet access so they can do Facebook, or they can read email, or are we giving them internet access to start whole new industries? So in rural Vermont, as part of the broadband stimulus grants that were given out by the federal government, Vermont got it. And what Vermont was going to do was to run fiber with the help of the Gates Foundation around rural Vermont and into the public libraries in these rural towns. And the idea is that they would drop it in the rural library and then people could connect to the library and then get this broadband access to the rest of the world. So we were having this meeting where we were talking to the librarians, trying to get them as part of the project, and one of the people from the Gates Foundation was getting very frustrated because the librarians were sitting there going, why would I pay $100 a month for gigabit access? And I know you have to be geeky to quite get why that is a ridiculous statement. Like, I wouldn't sell my child for that. Yes, I would. But when I pay $0 for a dial-up connection now. And so she finally got up and said, I don't think you people get it. And she was much kinder about this, but that's more or less what she said. I don't think you get it. Right now, think about the internet connection you have as a dirt path coming to your library. What we're offering you is the Autobahn connected to your library. And I was looking at the audience at the time. You could see their eyes getting wide. And their eyes weren't getting wide from recognition and excitement. They were getting wide because all they could see is German headlights racing to run them down. Right? What they saw was this idea that the Autobahn, for them, it was scary. They were going to bring in all this sort of data dump into the library. What were they going to do? How could they organize it? How could they make access to it? How could they utilize it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then what happened is other speakers got up and they said, you know, don't think of it as the Autobahn's fine. But remember that highways are two-way. And what we're really talking about is bringing you the ability to unleash your community on the rest of the internet. And so we begin to talk once again about economic development, democratic participation. But what they began to talk about was they told a story. And the story was of a gentleman who had retired. And all his life he loved snowmobiles. Loved snowmobiles. So he bought snowmobiles. He bought snowmobile parts. He bought broken snowmobiles. He bought all this other stuff. And by the time he retired, he ended up with a barn full of snowmobile parts. And what happened is on a break, his grandson came home from college and with his permission, took a digital camera and a laptop, inventoried all these snowmobile parts, and overnight put it on the internet in a way that people could come in and buy it, and they became a worldwide snowmobile distribution center. Because it turns out in Siberia, quite literally Siberia, there are all these broken snowmobiles where they can't get parts to them, and so they became one of the major consumers of the Vermont to Siberia connection selling snowmobile parts. That's a very different view from you can get and you can watch movies quickly now. To, you can start whole new businesses. You can take the businesses that you run now and make them available to the world. This idea that we can look at rural broadband not as a way of connecting people to consume, but connecting people to produce. Municipal Wi-Fi, municipal gigabit. Once again, talking about what's going on in Chattanooga, they put in a gigabit ring all around the city. And they said, alright, great, now what do we do with it? And the people who installed it, the town government installed it, turned to the library and said, can we talk about what content we can put on this? And once again, to their great credit, it wasn't simply we have these videos we can stream. It became we can bring the communities in and they can create things to stream and talk and have conversations going on. My point of this, once again, is if you look at remediation, it's not, well, here's my point. Yes, our communities have problems. Yes, we need to solve these problems. Yet, what motivates community action is aspirations, not constant reminders of failings. When we reach out to a community, we must not simply say, this is what's wrong with you, this is what's wrong with you, this is what's wrong with you. You can't read, you don't have access, you don't have tech skills. What we need to say is, did you know, if you increased your tech skills, if you increased your reading, if you increased your ability to connect and advocacy and all this, you can change the world? That's what motivates people to work. When you look at the libraries where people stand up for library initiatives, stand up for library funding, protest on campuses for longer library hours, they're libraries that have connected them to achievements. They're libraries that have helped people be better, to make something greater of themselves, not libraries that have sit there and done a great job of pointing out what the community can't do. But we also cannot see our members as consumers whose primary deficit is their ability to create. So let me switch now to this idea of why we need to kill the user. And really, it's kill the concept, not the person. And that's me. This is the only time in my life I ever had a ponytail. I was very excited. And what you see along that is about 24 electrodes tied up to my brain, monitoring it 24 hours a day at the Cleveland Clinic, and they were looking for epilepsy and seizures. Good news, didn't find anything. It was a good day. But I want you to think about this for a minute. What's happening is quite literally what's going on in my brain is being captured by those little electrodes, sent down that little ponytail, and then displayed to neurologists and doctors who are looking for any issues and problems. Now, if this were the grand old information technology is great, you could talk about, cool, and wirelessly we can monitor the brain, and we can visualize it, and we can diagnose problems and solve it. But what I want you to think about instead is, what's really going on here? For example, in this system, who's the user? Right, the idea of a user is a great idea. We love this idea of being user-based, user-designed, user experience, the user, the user, the user. But think about it for a minute. Are the doctors the users? In other words, this whole system of capturing data, transmitting data, displaying data, analyzing data, presenting data to the doctors, does that mean that the doctors are the users? If they are, what am I? I mean, this picture literally shows that I am part of the machine, right? Do we want to think of our communities as these idea of consumers, as part of a machine, as someone who simply uses us and walks away? Right? What we need to begin to think about is, where did this concept of user come from? And the user, there's an old joke that says only computer scientists and drug dealers have users. Right? This is not necessarily a great word for us to glom onto. And a worse word is consumer, and a worse word beyond that is the idea of customer. Libraries don't have consumers and customers and users. They have members. They have people who paid tuition or bottom line dollars or revenue sharing or tax dollars or what have you to create a library. And they're part of it. They're members of it. They belong. The library belongs to them as much as it belongs to a director position or a board. If we instead take this idea of user, then we simply become a service that's tacked onto the community. And once the user finds other convenient ways of getting their problems, solving their problems, or they don't need us, they simply jettison us away. If we're of the community, meaning the librarians and the members themselves are building, maintaining, advocating for, creating, promoting the library, then to get rid of a library is to get rid of part of themselves, which is a much more difficult thing to do. This idea of user actually comes from how we used to design systems. It comes from computer science. And the way we used to do it is we had the corpus, that is the information that we were looking for, all those articles at the time, metadata, the algorithms that we could sort through them, and system constraints. Things like you could only have 32 characters in a title field and all this stuff in the 70s. And the user was someone who was trained to get around the system constraints. This is the date that no one in this room probably remembers, but when someone would have a question, they would walk up to the librarian would do an interview, then the librarian would turn and enter that question into a system, search for articles, and present the results to the user. You know, no dirty-handed people off the street were allowed to touch EBSCO, right? Only we could do it because we understood the magical language of, you know, Boolean and ands and ors and nors and zors, etc. By the way, extra credit if you know what a zor is. This then transformed, and actually, Bob Taylor, who was the dean here at Syracuse, it's all about me, all about Syracuse, talked about the idea that, you know, we may have a corpus and we may have an algorithm, but it's actually the system constraints and whether it's worth it to the user to overcome the constraints that truly determines if a system's going to be successful. Now, this sounds to us like no duh, right? It sounds like if the system's hard to use, we won't use it. Duh. This comes from really work in the 80s and the early 90s that said the user is an important constituent in the system. It was a very positive view, right? If it's not easy to use, they won't use it. If you have to train them and teach them for hours and hours and days, it's not worth it any longer. The problem is we don't live in this world either. We live in this world. This is the world where quite literally we are building the systems around ourselves. And everyone's doing it who's connected to a computer. And by the way, we do it in analog and real life all the time. But if you're wondering what I mean, I want you to think about right now, this is the first year that worldwide smartphones have outshipped dumb phones, flip phones, and feature phones. But I want you to think about it. If you, for a moment, have your iPhone or you have an Android device or you have a smartphone, I want you to think about, are you a user of that phone? And before you say yes or no, how many of you, And I can't see you, so I'll take it. It's a lot. How many of you have added an app? Right? How many of you have an app on your phone that wasn't there when you bought it? And it's probably Angry Birds or Plants vs. Zombies or Solitaire, right? Let's face it, we do that. Now, this is a different thing. And how many times, for example, I have an iPhone and my wife has an iPhone, and every so often one of us will need the others, we'll forget our phone or something, so we borrow the others, and it takes us a half an hour to flip through the screen to look for the right icon, and why isn't that on the first screen like it's supposed to be, and where'd you move it into a folder? What we do, what we look at is now, you are not simply using a phone. Right? Using a phone is when you got the old bricks that you held up to your ear. Now what you're doing is you're really curating or orchestrating what your telecommunications experience looks like. Right? So in my case, my experience looks like it can make phone calls, it can text, and it can kill pigs with birds. Right? That's something that I didn't just use it, I made that decision. And so by the time you look at my phone, it is geared and organized around me. The content on it, my contacts, my phone numbers, my ideas, my notes, my messages, my what have you, that is really me building the phone. Think about Facebook for a moment. Facebook is an amazingly successful system, and it's an amazingly stupid system. It's designed to do like four things, right? It's designed to have friends, to make posts, and to sell your information for profit. That's what it's designed for. And yet, when you look at Facebook, you, by adding your friends, look at the language you use. Is that language anyone else would understand if they walked into your community? Look at the apps that you add to it. Look at the capabilities you add to it. Look at the information you provide to it. You're no longer using Facebook. Facebook, if anything, is using you. You're building that system around yourself. And we're not doing it alone anymore. Now we're doing it, once again, with friends and with systems, and we're talking through systems to other people. This concept of user doesn't fit. The idea that these are somehow consuming information is no longer true. We're producing information. We're sharing information. We're curating information. We're keeping information. We're deleting information. We are active participants in systems. So the idea that we are somehow looking at users is wrong. The history of user orientation grew out of a system perspective. A user was what's not the system. It's designed as a very simple dialogue between a person and a system. It's not social. And increasingly, when we say user, what we really mean is consumer. Someone who's going to buy and pay for. And those who champion user-based are abandoning the term as too limited. Information scientists that once were big on users are starting to say, this is a bad word. Now, there's a quest for a better term. Participant. I like member when it comes to library. Creator. Prosumer. Don't use prosumer. Someone published prosumer. It's a bad word. But anyway, it gets the point. So what I want you to think about for a minute is, one, when we look at communities as deficits, when we look at them as problem-seeking solutions, and we constantly are reminding the community of those problems, eventually the community will stop listening and not want to participate. Instead, if we look at them as aspirations and having dreams, you know, think of the true role of a librarian is not to organize collections, it's to fulfill the dreams of a community. We are in the dream business, we're in the aspiration business. People who use the library shouldn't walk out feeling like, God, I've just gone from nothing to normal. People should walk out of a library going, I've just gone from normal to exceptional. I'm an extraordinarily individual. I have dreams that I never thought I could achieve without the library to it. That's the message. But to do that, we need to look at those people who are coming to us not as users and consumers and customers, but as members, as part of us, and as people who want to produce and build knowledge as much as they want to consume it. And so that leads to how we work with the user, how we work with the member now, how we work with our participant, how we work with the community, is that we need to now shift our set of services from the idea of lending to sharing. So this is a picture of Benjamin Franklin, and this isn't about money. But Benjamin Franklin, you know, apparently was the genius besides who wanted to make the state bird a turkey, but the national bird a turkey. Well, he's the first to do everything, right? And if you're in Philadelphia, you'll know that he's the first to build a library. But what's interesting is he didn't actually build the first public library, as some people like to say. His library was a subscription library. In essence, he ran out of room for all his books, or he got really tired of all his friends coming over late at night to borrow them, and so he and a bunch of the affluent people with lots of materials rented a building and combined their collected volumes and through a subscription fee upkept the building and the collection. So he created the first subscription library in Philadelphia. The first public library, just in case you're into trivia, was actually created by, and I'm not making this up particularly to a Texas audience, Dr. Pepper. Dr. Pepper was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania with a very rich uncle at the University of Pennsylvania, and he gathered a bunch of money to build what is now the Free Library of Philadelphia, which was the first public library in Philadelphia, and he built it not for the accumulation of materials, he built it for the common good of the citizen. This is where you very much see in the early 1900s the idea of democratic participation becoming fundamental to the idea of a public library. That is, that citizens who are uninformed cannot participate effectively within government, and so, you know, from the Jeffersonian ideal. And so the idea is that libraries and public libraries, from Carnegie to Pepper to Jefferson, was to build public libraries that allowed people to learn and become better citizens. So that's sort of a new idea. But actually, in doing that, while he brought in Pepper brought in this idea of a democratic ideal and moved along, which is fabulous, he lost something very powerful, which is the idea of sharing. Now, the definition, aren't these synonymous, right? Sharing is to combine resources together to create a richer commons. Lending is allowing people to borrow from a common resource. Aren't they the same thing? Well, here's the difference. The more you share, the more you have. The more you lend, the less you have. And I want to give you an example. So the example is, we're going to throw a party. We're going to throw a nice dinner party. Now, model number one on the left, with these delightful people with red glasses, this is the Martha Stewart-esque view, right? So you invite 10 of your friends, and you go out and you buy 10 pieces of the wonderful tenderloin beef, and you buy enough potatoes to make this, and you design it all, and you put it on these lovely plates, and the 10 people come and they consume the information. They consume the meal. The problem is, what happens if those 10 people decide to bring a date? Suddenly you have 20 people. And you look at all the stuff that you bought, you look at the steak, and you start cutting the steak in half, and you start making more potatoes because they're cheap, and then you start ordering out. The point is that this is a sharing, this is a lending model. In essence, you build the collection, you build the resource, in this case a meal, and you divvy it out. And the more people who come in, then that resource is limited, the less each one gets. Now what I want you to do is throw the same party for the 10 people, but this time we're going to do it by having the bring-your-own-meal, right? We're going to have the potluck dinner. And that is, you invite 10 friends and you tell them to bring each one to bring their own dish. You'll provide the soda, you'll provide the space, you'll provide the tables, but if those 10 people invite their 10 friends, then you have 20 meals coming. And if those people invite their friends, and they told a friend, and they told a friend, as everyone brings in a meal, right, that's where we end up with like 20 gallons of queso dip, because for some reason everyone brings queso dip, and we're trying to figure out, you know, what to do with the chips. The idea, though, is the more people that are involved in that party, the more resources there are. That's a sharing model. So what I want you to think about is something called the network effect. When you move to this idea of sharing, you end up with something called the network effect. So there's a picture of a very fancy fax machine. Good old days of fax machines. The very first fax machine ever produced cost a lot of money and was completely useless. It wasn't until the second fax machine was hooked into the telephone network that any value came of having a fax machine, because you had someone to send something to. And as more people bought fax machines, every fax machine that got added to that network made the network more effective, made it more powerful, and lowered your initial investment cost. And so this is something called the network effect. The more you bring to something, the more you allow people to add into the network, the more value you get out of your one small investment. We see this in social networks, right? MySpace used to be the place to be until Facebook came along. And suddenly everyone migrated from MySpace over to Facebook, and MySpace became nothing, right? Now it's a music service and they're trying desperately, but we all know Facebook's the place to be until the next thing comes. Twitter is a piece, you know, 140 characters to send you a picture of my dinner. What's the value in that? But suddenly, as your friends and your family and your contacts and professional people become on Twitter, suddenly as people add to this network, it becomes more powerful. We see this in professional associations. If the Texas Library Association consisted of two people getting together in Dallas to share recipes, it wouldn't be a very powerful association. The more members it has, it's not because the more dues are paid, but because the more networking opportunities for conferences like this, the more powerful it is. That's why we build consortia. We see this in MARC records. You know, OCLC made the MARC record useful. Now OCLC is, of course, killing the MARC record for RDA, but that's a different conversation. We see the power that once we join OCLC, we suddenly get this power of networking together. So think about this for a moment now. You have a collection. In a lending model, let's look at the lending model for a minute. You have a collection of books, materials, databases, etc. If only one person was using your library, it would be an amazingly powerful resource. But that's not how it works, right? We have communities that do it. And that means when we buy the Harry Potter book, we have to buy 50 copies of Harry Potter. Right? Because if we only had one copy, as that book becomes more and more popular, people get added to wait lists, and their access to that goes down and down and down and down. So by building a finite collection that people can borrow from, we're ultimately rationing access to our resource. Not of the community, but for the community. But we know how to solve this. We build consortia. Right? The old joke. You know, what do you call two librarians in a bar? A consortia. Right? And so now we can borrow books and materials from our friends and neighbors. And that's great, except that you got to realize they're serving communities too. And so the popular stuff's going to be popular no matter where you're in the consortia. So if you limit it to what a library owns, what they can license, what they can get, you're ultimately going to be in the land of rationing use. Now, we know that that means that we're going to ration the use of about 20% of our collection, and 80% of our collection won't circulate from 1960. But in essence, we're still rationing use. We have to, you have an hour on the public access terminals, and now you've got to give us your library card, and what have you. Oh, you can't access this database outside from home. You have to be in our physical facility. All of this is because we are building a collection that people borrow from. We're lending out our collection. We're rationing use. What we need to do is look at those folks not as users, not as consumers, not as customers, because that's what this model is. But we need to say, you know what? Those folks have resources too. This happened in Ann Arbor, Ann Arbor Public Library. Eli Nyberger tells the story much better than I do. He had a member, a patron, come in and say, you know how I can go online and I can search and find out if a book's at this library? And Eli said, yes. He goes, you know how I can find out if the book isn't here but it's in another branch? Eli said, yep, got it. He goes, well, I've got books at home. Why can't they go to the catalog to find out if I've got the book? I'm perfectly willing to bring it in and loan it out. Now, if you're in a lending model, that makes no sense. That's crazy talk. That's just, what in the world? That's not our stuff. And how would we barcode it? Would we have to catalog it? Could, for God's sake, we put plastic on it? Does anyone else get offended to realize that putting plastic on a book is roughly equivalent to putting plastic on couches and dining room tables? I mean, let's be honest here. Right? But if we look at, instead, a sharing model, that is that we bring the community's resources together, some of which we commonly aggregate money to buy, some of which we individually buy but are willing to share, suddenly it makes a lot of sense. Because, and then, they have more than just books. They have pictures and photographs, and they have apps that they've built, and they have devices. So, I love this. I just heard about one of our student groups is working with a library to create a baking pan lending collection. So, once again, if you're anything like my family, you know, when my son was 5 years old, he had to have the Elmo cake. So you bought the Elmo cake pan so you could make Elmo-shaped cake. Well, then he turned 12, and he didn't want the Elmo cake anymore, but you, by God, have the baking pan. Yay! Meanwhile, your friend's sitting there with the Big Bird cake, and they're over there with the Fudgy the Whale cake, and someone else has got the, you know, whatever it is. And so what this library said is, you know what? You're only baking one cake. We're going to build a collection of baking pans. So you can come into your public library, and you can borrow the Elmo baking pan. And you can borrow the Big Bird baking pan. But what's genius about this is they didn't then go out and buy a bunch of baking pans. They went to the community and said, have a baking pan you no longer need, build a collection with it. And so the community is quite literally building a collection of baking pans from their own resources at low to zero cost to the library, but the library is creating a resource that is of great value to that community. What we begin to see is that the library shifts its role from a collection and a resource to lend out to a platform. So people can still go through this platform and borrow from this common collection. No one is going to license databases like we do. No one individual can. It's only by aggregating tax dollars or tuition dollars or bottom line dollars that we can do that. So there's still a value to the sort of group buying exercise. But the library can then also provide access to each other's resources, and to me, most exciting, to each other. That is, my wife created a mom's club here in Syracuse. And they wanted to, it started out with like five friends, and they used to get together every once a month and say, here are activities. Then it turned to 10 friends. Then it turned to 50 friends. Last we looked at it, it was somewhere near 500 mothers that were part of this network. They couldn't get together anymore. They became a virtual club. They moved to a network. Where they looked to see, how could we create, in essence, a social network of moms that restricts access, that provides us a way of disseminating information, all this other stuff. They looked around, and what they found was Yahoo groups. Why couldn't they have done that at the library? Why couldn't the library create a resource and a platform for you? It's hosting a blog, more or less, where we become a way of starting communications and conversations together, right? So one of the things that this doesn't just have to be in the form of materials and stuff. This is a picture from the library farm at the North Onondaga Public Library. North Onondaga Public Library had people coming to the library saying, we want to know how to garden. Now, that could be, oh, here's a gardening book, or our collection's thin, let's go buy gardening books. But what they really then realized is, you know the one thing we've got a lot of? Land. Why don't we build a garden? And they built a garden, and they broke it into plots, and they loaned out plots to the community. And people, they had lecture series, people coming in, yes, they had books and materials, but people learned about gardening by gardening. And so they then, once the 3,000 tomatoes showed up in September, they then learned about local food sourcing and where they could give food and et cetera. But what I love about this is that it was a community-driven effort. One of the things that I love is, you know, the baking pan collection. In Wisconsin, they loan out fishing poles. They have seed collections that people loan out. All of these things. Ukulele. There's a ukulele loan collection. What drives me nuts is I love the idea of sharing based on resources of the community and what they care about. What drives me nuts is when libraries look at that and say, oh, God, I got to go buy a bunch of fishing poles. I got to buy a bunch of baking pans. I got to buy a bunch of ukuleles. But that's a different view. That's the lending model again. That's the idea. Tell me that someone doesn't have a ukulele in their basement that they don't need. Tell me someone has a ukulele they actually do need, and I'll be more surprised. But the idea here is why not look at the community as the resource and the library as a platform of sharing that, not of accumulating it, not of buying it, not of managing and owning it, but facilitating the access. This is my son, and he's holding his vision of the library of the future. And what he did was he had a science fair project coming up, and yes, he's my geek son, you can blame me. He wanted to build the library of the future for his science fair project. And it was very cool. It had lots of things flying around in it. But what he did is he started making drawings. And then his older brother said, hey, we can build that in Minecraft. And if you don't know what Minecraft is, find out what Minecraft is. It's like Legos, but electronic, and with creepers that can kill you. It's very addictive. And so what he did is they actually went into Minecraft and built the library of the future. So they had a 3D model, interactive model they could navigate around. And then that was really cool, but we lived down the street from Fayetteville Public Library that has built a makerspace. They had a 3D printer. And so I went and I found this program that will export a Minecraft model into something that can be fed to a 3D printer, and what he's holding in his hands is the model that came right out of Minecraft from his drawings. Now, this is a great, cool thing, right? That's a fabulous story to tell. But there's a discussion about whether makerspaces belong in libraries, whether public, academic, school, it doesn't matter. And a lot of people look at it going, oh, God, a 3D printer. Librarians sit there and go, I have trouble enough with 2D printers and toner cartridges. Now you're going to make me get into PVC and all this other crap. And one person said, well, so what do you want? Librarians now have to learn 3D geometry and this coding language and all this other stuff. And I said, they missed the point. The point is not to create makerspaces where the librarians teach people how to make things. The point is to create makerspaces where people teach the community from the community how to make things, and the library shares that information and builds that platform. So back to the makerspace in Fayetteville. They had something called, they had a workshop where they got 20 kids in, and they were going to build bristle bots. Bristle bots are where you take a toothbrush, you clip off just the bristles on the top of the toothbrush, you attach an old pager vibrating mechanism with a watch battery, and it vibrates along the table, and you can race them. And this was really cool. Except what happened was they quickly realized that the watch batteries they bought run for about a minute or two and then run out of power. And they were having problems figuring out where to get the batteries. And so about 10 minutes into the workshop, all the librarians were clustered in the corner figuring out who's going to go buy the batteries. And all the kids are left to their own devices. You know what the kids did? They found AA batteries. They said, why do we just do the bristles? And they found duct tape. And suddenly they were creating bristle tanks, and they were creating bristle carriers, and they were having bristle wars. And what suddenly dawned on the librarians, and me watching this, was the point of this bristle workshop wasn't for librarians to teach the kids how to beat bristle bots. It was to build an environment in which the kids could discover, explore, and play. Because play is the most powerful form of learning. So when you look at makerspaces and 3D printing, and you look at gardening, and you look at ukulele collections, and you look at all of this, the point is not us buy it, us teach community how to use it. It's us identify that the community wants it. We build an environment in which they can then come and teach and learn and play and design and develop. And that's the resource. It's not just the 3D printer. It's the expertise of the community who comes in and figures it out. It's the 12-year-old who is sitting there printing out this 3D thing. And the librarian said, oh, next week we're having a hackathon. And we're going to have lots of tables where you can build bristle bots and 3D printing. And we want to do duct tape, but I can't find anyone who does good duct tape. And my 12-year-old said, I love duct tape. I built lots of stuff. And in seconds, he had his iPod out with showing pictures of battle axes and things he built with it. And the librarian, just like that, turned to him and said, great, you're in charge of duct tape. Can I just tell you, a 12-year-old talking for 2 weeks about how important and powerful he was, how amazing he was, how he was recognized for something very valuable that he was never going to be tested on in school, but now a librarian valued what he did. That's the power we have. When we look past the community as a set of problems, when we look past the community as users who are only coming to the library to consume, but we look at the community as a set of resources and values that we are unleashing to the community's good. Ultimately, what we're talking about is not looking at the community as a set of problems that we are going to solve, and not looking at them as a set of users who are only coming us to consume and leave, but instead looking at the community as a set of valuable aspirations, capabilities, resources that could reach beyond what we could ever produce on our own. To be of the community, part of the community. When academic libraries, when a manga club, which is Japanese comics, came to an academic library and said, we'd like to start a collection of manga. The library said, oh, we can't afford it. We can't afford to buy manga and copy and collect it and code it, and it'll take us 10 months. The manga club says, we already have all of it. Can't you just give us some space? And the librarian went, ding, here, this 10 feet of linear shelving is yours. But by the way, these things might walk away. And by the way, if they don't have a barcode, we can't put them in the catalog. So if you want to get them in the catalog, we're going to have to figure something out. And by the way, if they're out of order, we need someone to come in order. And the manga club said, that's fine. That's our choice. And so now the manga club looks at the library as a valuable place, and they look at it as us. They look at it as a place not to go find reading material, but as a place to promote their reading material and the things that they're interested in. This idea that the library becomes a center of sharing and a center of aspirations, and not as a place simply to consume and walk away. Ultimately, what we're talking about with new librarianship is not the idea that what's new is the services we offer, the technology, or social networking is connected. That's not what's new about librarianship. What's new about librarianship is not the fact that we're even reinventing librarianship. The way that we honor, librarianship has a 3,000-year-plus, a 3-millennia-plus history. And it has that history, and a valuable and noble history, not because we didn't change, not because we're still doing what they did in Alexandria, but because we change on a regular basis. We took the effort to take the chains off the books. We allowed them to circulate. We suddenly brought the idea of new resources and new materials. All the things that we as librarians learned about information organization, preservation, and access in a physical collection is desperately needed in a digital world. We need librarians to stand up and advocate for the idea of open access. We need librarians to stand up and say, this is what it takes to build a true collection, and it's not simply waiting to the data center to be taken down. We need policy, we need law, we need regulation to take care of this. This is the power that libraries and librarians have within our communities. What makes new librarianship new is the realization that the collection is not what's behind you, it's not what's in the stacks, it's not what's in the building, it is the community itself. And that collection development is not a matter of completion of title or evaluating a publisher, but evaluating the dreams and aspirations of the individuals who come to us. What is new about librarianship, and I don't care if you're 10 or 90 or 1,000 years old, what is new that we seek to embrace is the idea that this is a learning community, we are in the learning business, and that community and people are at the fundamental core of what we do. That we are of and fundamentally part of the community with members, not simply a service to be used, consumed, and discarded. We are not a collection of books and materials that have a date. We're not going to chase the e-book chain, and that's going to win for us. E-books will be figured out. And after e-books, it will be something else. What we need to understand is the reason we have books and e-books as tools to begin with is that people want to learn. People want to question. People want to participate. People want to be their own government. People want to be their own creators and educational systems. Long after the day that Syracuse University and every university crumbles under the intense pressure of academic debt and new models of lifelong learning, libraries will be essential organizations standing ready to help communities invent the next future. That future is ours to invent, and we are fundamental to it. I invite you to be part of it. Thank you, and I hope we have time for questions.